Hi, my name is Kunal, and welcome to the Geeks of the Valley podcast, which connects with some of the brightest minds globally who are leading their respective industries today to discuss the hottest upcoming industry trends and how their work is affecting the global economy. This morning, from the Salt Lake City, Utah area, we have the founder of investment fund Secrets joining us. Please welcome Bridger Pennington. Bridger, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, man, it's fun to be on Geeks of the Valley podcast, dude. It should be a good time.
And Bridger, how are things for you in light of COVID over there in the United States?
Yeah, things are good. Honestly, in Utah, really COVID, I would say doesn't really exist here. I mean, we are 100% open. No one wears masks. I literally don't even think about COVID like at all in my everyday life, at least in Utah. It's pretty great. Yeah. Anyways, hospital rates are low. It's like COVID's not really here. Even with Omicron, it's really not been much of a deal. So, and also, you know, it comes down to the mindset of you though, whether you're in a lockdown place or not. Like, I think a lot of people get in this mindset of like, you know, I can't do anything because I'm locked down. And then you have other people. I have friends that have made tens of millions of dollars during COVID, you know, starting a new business, whatever, and because of COVID. And so anyways, I think it's a mentality shift that you've got to have, regardless of the culture, regardless of the government. Like, you know, there's a lot of money moving pockets right now. So,
you know, what do you think is the cause of that?
I think when the world changes, doesn't necessarily have to be suffering, but I think when the world changes, there's a lot of opportunity created in that change. And a lot of that opportunity comes through suffering. Like you said, dot-com bubble, 2007, 2008 crash, COVID, are very obvious examples of major, major innovations and startups and companies that were built out of those ashes. We do a lot of things with investment funds, and we can probably talk about that during this episode, but I've gone back and studied a lot of the best money managers of our century in the last, you know, 100 years, guys like Warren Buffett, Ray Dalio, Ken Griffin. You can go on, George Soros, all these big names. And it's really interesting. Almost all of them started their funds out of a market correction, out of a downturn. And that created, Paul Tudor Jones is a great example. He became a billionaire after World War II because while everybody was fearful of American stocks, he went all in on American stocks, and just America happened to win the war and was the most, you know, the only country really intact after World War II, and turned him into a billionaire. And and one of the wealthiest people in Europe and around the world. And so anyways, I think right now we are going through and still going through, right now we have the convergence of a ton of technologies. We have a convergence of AI, 5G, high-speed internet for, you know, the entire world. You have, you know, flying now, then you have all these new technologies rolling out because of that. And it's this kind of convergence that's happening, this whole shift in the world. And when the world changes, there's a ton of opportunity that's created for people that want to, you know, innovate and be entrepreneurs, and, you know, and they're heavily rewarded for doing that and taking the risk.
So Bridger, tell me about yourself and your background and how it really led you to the path of not just starting investment fund Secrets, but also Blackbridge Holdings.
Yeah. So, I started out, I grew up in near Salt Lake City. I grew up in an average household, went to college. I started 6 different businesses my first 2 years of college. And excuse my voice. Sorry, I've been a little sick the last couple of days, but, I get to college and I was like, man, I'm going to start. So, like, I want to innovate. I want to be one of these rich entrepreneur guys, you know? So I would listen to these podcasts and read books and do courses and all that kind of stuff. I literally started 6 companies my first 2 years of college. And we had employees and stuff. I speak Mandarin Chinese. We did Chinese tutoring. I did a real estate. We wholesaled 2 houses. I built websites for people. We did Forex trading. We sold chocolates online. I'm just going through. It was pretty fun. And finally, my dad grabs me and he goes, Bridger, you're kind of like a chicken with your head cut off. I want you to go meet with one of my business partners. I think this guy can really help you out. And I said, okay. Well, I'll go meet with whoever, and no big deal. And so we set up this appointment. I start driving to this guy's house, And mine, my dad, we grew up in a, you know, I would say an average house. My dad drove with a car with 300,000 miles on it. And I pull up through this gated community and I'm like, huh. And I pull in, there's these massive, huge houses. And I'm like, wow, this is pretty legit. And I pull up to the top of this hill and there's this gorgeous white house on top of this hill, just huge house. And I was like, man, like, who is this? Like, who's my dad's business partner? This guy seems amazing. And I go knock on the door and I'm kind of worried, you know, like I'm worried like a butler is going to come and like, you know, be gone peasant, like get out of here kind of thing. And anyways, I knock on this guy's door and he opens the door and he goes, Bridger, come on in. And I walk in this guy's house and, you know, he's got the wine cellar and the grand piano and the basketball court in his basement, the cars, the whole nine yards, this huge house. And I was super impressed. And I walk in, I sit down and we start to chat. And I start talking to this guy and I finally get to the point. I'm just talking to him. I go, how did you do this? Like, how did you get all of this? Like, how did you, you know, how'd you do this? And he goes, Bridger, it's funny you asked me that question. He goes, not a lot of people ask me that question. And I was like, oh shoot, sorry. I mean, that's like the only question I had was like, how did you make all this money? Like, how'd you do this? And he goes, well, let me tell you. And he goes, when I was in my 20s, I was a lot like you. I had moderate success. I actually started some successful companies. But then he goes, then I figured out the secrets of the ultra wealthy. I figured out what the ultra wealthy of the world do. And he goes, they all in some way, shape, or form work in private equity, hedge funds, venture capital, or they run their own family offices. They work in this fund world. And he goes, I met a guy who ran a private equity fund. And he was one of the wealthiest people I'd ever met. And he said, you know, he said at that time, I said, I don't care how long it takes me. I don't take care if it takes me 1 year, 5 years, or 20 years. I was going to figure out what a fund was and how to start one. He goes, that's what we did. He goes, me and your dad started a fund. And he goes, right now we manage just over $8 billion of real estate. And I was blown away. I was like, $8 billion with a B, $8 billion of real estate they managed. I was like, wow, this is crazy. And, you know, to put that into perspective, anybody on here follows Grant Cardone or Cardone Capital manages just over $2 billion. This is four times bigger than Cardone Capital. And today they're well over, you know, $20 billion in their funds. And it was just crazy. I was like, wow, this is incredible. And I've heard from people like you on podcasts, you know, everyone says, find mentors. So I kind of said, hey, will you be my mentor? I'd love to learn from you. I'd love to have you teach me. And he goes, Bridger, go talk to your dad because your dad knows way more about us than I do. And I said, no. My dad's, you know, poor. We live in an average house. You live in this huge house. Like, I want to learn from you. And he kind of laughs. He goes, Bridger, sorry to break it to you, but me and your dad make about the same amount of money. And at that moment, my chin dropped on the floor. I was like, huh? Like, come again? He's like, yeah, I mean, me and your dad are pretty much equal business partners. And I was shocked. And I left the dude's house. I drove straight to my dad's house. And I was like, Dad, what the heck? Like, what's going on? Like, you have all this money. Like, why haven't I been able to order dessert at dinner for the last 10 years? Cause it's too expensive, but yet you're running this, you know, multi-billion dollar fund. And anyways, by the way, feel free to interrupt me if you want, as I'm going, but, my dad, he kind of laughs and he goes, Bridger, he goes, yeah, you know, we do okay. And yeah, we run these big funds. And he goes, I'm just more, you know, I'm more conservative. I don't like to, you know, show off my money, but yeah, that's, you know, kind of what we do. And anyways, long story short, my dad started teaching me about funds and we'd sit down every Sunday night. He'd map out on a whiteboard how funds worked and how the general partners, limited partnerships, how to raise capital, how to put together decks and all the whole thing. And what's a funny thing that happens is when you start to learn about something, you start to recognize that thing in your life. Same thing, if you're going to buy a new car, you start to see that car around you. And so I said, shoot, like I started to recognize opportunities. And I was at the time I'm in college, I'm working for a company as well to try to pay my way through college because my dad's not giving me any money. And I was at this company and I had an idea that we could start a fund, an investment fund inside of this company. And I was like, shoot, like this is awesome. And I thought it was a great idea. I took it to my dad. He loved the idea. I talked to the owners of the company. They thought it was a great idea. And I was at this startup company. I was like, shoot, let's do it. And so we put together all the, you know, documents and we thought through the whole fund. And I finally hit this wall of like, shoot. The one thing you need for a fund is investors. You need money. You need capital. Like, where am I going to find money? And I thought, aha, I'll just go talk to my dad. like easy. My dad's got money. He would love to invest in my fund. And so I remember it was a late Sunday night. I walked into my dad's office, his home office. And I said, Dad, I sat down with him. I said, I want to thank you so much for helping me with my fund and all that kind of stuff. And I crossed the table. I said, Dad, how would you like to be our first investor into our fund? And, you know, I kind of said it with my best pitch voice possible, the, you know, very best way I could pitch him. And anyways, my dad smiles and he goes, Bridger, I have the money to invest, but if I invest in your fund, I would ruin the experience of you raising capital on your own. And he goes, if I invest in your fund, this will be a crutch that you'll never be able to recover from. And he said, no. And, he said, I won't invest in your fund. And I kind of left his office with my tail between my legs. And, I was a little obviously sad, man, what am I going to do? And my own dad won't believe in me. And anyways, I walked down, I said, you know what? I'm going to take him up on the challenge. And I took my dad up on the challenge. I said, you know what? I'm doing this. And I hit the streets. I talked to everybody I knew. I talked to former bosses, college professors, friends, whoever it was. And I raised a whopping $49,500 for this first little teeny micro syndication fund. If you don't think about funds, that's teeny. That's not even, and you know, barely enough to get started. And, but I was excited and it was enough to get started. We were doing these small little loans that were like $2,000 to $5,000 a loan. And I said, I'm going to do this. And so we launched our first little fund and, lo and behold, our first group of investors, we got them a 64% return on their money, which was just insane. We were so excited about it. It was awesome. And, we were stoked. And from there we small a dollar amount, but you know, big return. And we said, let's do it. So we launched a second fund, and that fund we raised, deployed millions of dollars out of that fund. I just sold that fund. We ran that for about 3.5-4 years, just sold that fund earlier this year. And then right now we're launching two more funds. We have a crypto fund coming out. We have about 15 million soft raised for that fund. And then a real estate fund. We've got about, I would say about 50 million soft raised for that fund that's coming out here pretty soon. So, and then along that journey, we've had, it was awesome starting those funds and doing that. We've had a lot of people reach out to us and say, you know, Bridger, and my dad, and I didn't mention my brother. So my brother is a securities attorney. My brother does law for funds, and he was at a $700 million real estate fund prior. He's right now at the largest firm in the world that does real investment funds. And so, and the three of us, none of us went to Ivy League schools. None of us have the fancy background. All of us are just hustling entrepreneurs that have just figured this thing out. And so, we've had a lot of people ask us how to start these funds and how do we do this? So that's where we started Investment Fund Secrets. And so we started a group online. It started with a podcast and it turned into coaching and consulting and other stuff. Right now we have over 4,000 students in our program. And it's been incredible. We have two funds that are over $100 million each, dozen plus funds, anywhere from like 5 million to 30 million. And then we have one fund that's just over $2.5 billion that we've helped launch and run with them. And it's been awesome. So anyways, that's kind of the story of how we got into this, and it's been an incredible ride, and we're still in the game right now.
And Bridger, given, you know, this wealth of experience, and going into your third fund now, what have you found is the toughest aspect in starting a fund? You know, many people would say licenses would be maybe a barrier to entry here.
Yeah, I think a lot of people get tied up on, you know, the SEC and trying to get licenses or regulations and all the, you know, red tape. And I from the outside looking in, 100%, that's for me too, as the first thing that scared me. I was like, oh shoot, like this seems so hard. I don't even want to start, you know? And the analogy I use for that is it's like rugby. And I don't know if you know rugby much. I don't really know a lot about rugby, but when you see rugby, or let's call it even American football, that's probably a better example. American football from the outside looking in, it's a pretty weird sport. Like American football, they're like kicking the ball, then they're running, and then there's a fourth down, there's punts, there's like what is this game, you know? And if you just watched, like if you walked into a random stadium and started watching American football, you'd be pretty confused and probably frustrated and want to, you know, you're like, ah, screw this, I don't want to watch anymore. However, if someone sat down with you for 30 minutes, and while you watched the game, they explained the rules to you and explained what it meant to be on a third down, what a field goal was and a punt and all these, you know, offsides and a fumble and all these different terms. After about 30 minutes, you'd go, oh, okay, I kind of get it. And, you know, probably after an hour, you could probably think of some strategies and say, oh, that's a bad call or that's a good call. You would know a decent amount and maybe even be able to strategize on what's going on. I think the same thing's true with securities law. A lot of people from the outside, it's like, oh man, like this seems so tricky. And like, I don't even know. But when you sit down with somebody and you learn for 30 minutes or an hour, and you start to learn the rules of the game, then all of a sudden, like I can figure out the rules and you know, play the rules to my advantage and strategize on the rules. And so anyways, that's how I think about it. As far as regulations, back to your question though, the hardest piece, you know, I think it's different for every person. Some people, the hardest piece is raising capital. Some people, the hardest piece is, you know, finding the right deals and finding right investments and vetting those deals. Other people, it is the licenses, right? It is the regulations. But in my opinion, and I'll probably share this multiple times today, inside of the fund world, I kind of draw out three distinct circles. So I say, what I call the expert investor, the fund manager, and the money raiser. The expert investor is, you know, really good at investing. They're the nerd that's been in the basement for 20 years trading options, you know, or someone that has really great experience investing in startups or whatever. That person is your expert investor. The next person is your, what I call the fund manager. This person is really good at the legal stuff, accounting, compliance, licenses, all that kind of stuff. And then finally, the last person is your money raiser. This person's very well connected, knows how to find capital and raise capital. Typically in a fund, no one does all three. Some people do, I will say that. But typically the person who's really good at finding great deals and investing sometimes isn't that great at raising capital. And also isn't that great at like the licenses and the structure, right? And so I think I tell people to change your question. Don't ask how. Stop asking how. How do I get the license, or how do I raise money, or how do I find the investments? Change the question to who. Change your how to who. Who can I find that I can raise capital from? Who can I find that can be a great expert investor? Who can I find that's a great fund manager for me?
So Bridger, kind of given this, what type of fund structures have you seen have been the most common recently?
To be honest, I wouldn't say there's like a big trend. I'll give you a few insights though, at least what I see. I see a lot of innovation happening though in the fund space where people are being, it's not like, hey, we're going to start a traditional venture capital fund and we're going to invest into tech startups and try to beat Sequoia. It's like, okay, it's probably a losing game to try to beat Sequoia. You know what I mean? However, I see a lot of funds saying, you know what, let's do something different. Let's only invest in, tech startups out of Argentina. And we're going to focus on that little niche. Or secondly, they'll say, let's do a venture capital fund, but also we're going to mix it with a real estate fund. We have one grin guy that was such a cool idea. They would build on college campuses, student housing only for entrepreneurs. So they would bring in STEM majors, computer scientists, finance, entrepreneur type of people, and they make them all room together. And number one, they could charge premiums for the student housing. So you had to be vetted and interviewed to live in this, you know, apartment complex. You would pay more because it's cool to be there. And then third, they said, hey, we have a venture capital fund. We want to invest into student-run startups. And every, you know, quarter, every month, anyone from this group can pitch our venture capital fund. And that's where they would score really early stage deals because they were right on the university campus, which I thought was super unique and really cool. So anyways, I see a lot of innovation happening where they're, you know, going into different niches. Right now, we do see a big wave into crypto funds, kind of a new asset class. Crypto funds are doing really well, and anyways, we've seen a lot of movement into there. So I would say, you know, we'll still see a lot of, you know, traditional hedge funds, traditional private equity, traditional real estate, because there is still so much opportunity in the fund space for a few reasons. Number one, funds are capped with the number of investors they can take. So Ray Dalio's funds with Bridgewater, they only can take 2,000 investors. That's it. And that's why, you know, they haven't raised new money for the last 10 years. They only have 2,000 investors, like average investments, like $1 billion. And so they, you know, they aren't even competing with you. If you launched a competing hedge fund to Bridgewater, you're not even competing as far as investors go, because investors can't even access those funds. They need new funds to get into because of certain laws. So it leaves a lot of opportunity and a space available for funds.
So let's detail this last part. When you say it leaves a lot of opportunity and space available, what do you mean by that?
Well, yeah, back to the, you know, investors, right? Like, you're not even raising, if you started a fund that's going to trade just like Bridgewater, you're not even competing with investors on them. Their minimum commitment, this is 10 years ago, minimum investor for them had to have a $5 billion net worth, minimum commitments, $100 million to even talk to Ray Dalio and their funds. So if you started a fund today, you're not even in the same universe as them. You're pitching investors with, you know, $10 million, $20 million, $100 million. They're not even in this, it's a blue ocean. And then eventually, guess what? You're going to raise enough money that you'll move out and you'll start raising for people with 100 million or 2 billion, you know, 200 million or now 500 million, then a billion, right? Because you need, because you're capped at a certain number of investors. So you kind of get priced out. The other thing is there is, this works only for certain types of funds, but like private equity is a great example. A lot of shops, they raise so much as they get bigger and bigger, they raise a lot of money and they have to deploy that money. So they only want to do big deals. So, and let's say day one, they were doing the average deal size was $1 million, but they started to raise more money. So now average deal size is 5 million and 10 million. Then average deal size is 50 million. Then average deal size becomes 250 million for an average deal size. Well, because they have grown so much, they want to do bigger deals. That leaves a whole gap for new managers like me and you to move in and do deals at $1 million and $2 million and $3 million, right? And so that's only for certain types of funds. Private equity is a good example. Even venture though, you know, a lot of funds move out of the seed phase. And anyways, and same with investor phase, you end up not competing with these big funds, which is kind of cool.
It's a very interesting perspective and way of putting it. So to get a bit of taste around the thinking you grew up with, tell us a bit about the restaurant story and how it played a role in the mentality of not having an excuse to be successful in life.
I think the story you're referring to is with my dad, something that he would point out growing up. So my dad, we'd go to a restaurant and he would always point this out to me when I was growing up, was that if, you know, he'd know the restaurant owner and he'd be say, hey, you know, this guy, he moved here from, you know, China or Korea, wherever it was from. And you go, this guy, he moved here 5 years ago, couldn't speak English, came with no money, and still can barely speak English, but yet he runs, you know, two restaurants and a laundromat down the street. And he would say, you know, Bridger, he goes, Bridger, you grew up in America, you speak English as your first language, and you have access to the internet. Like, you have YouTube, you have all these things to learn. And he always point out, he says, Bridger, you have no excuse not to be successful. You have no excuse not to, you know, do something big and to, you know, at least, you know, this guy is living the American dream. And so many people just give up on themselves. They never even try. And he goes, you've been given so much opportunity just by the location you were born, the language you speak, like that alone, you're doing, you know, so much better. He goes, you essentially have no excuse to not be successful. And I remember that stuck with me since I was a kid. And I think it's really true. I think a lot of people never take a chance on themselves. Another mentor I had in college, and this is when I was starting my business, I was a little worried. I was like, man, should I start a business or should I not start a business? He was like, what are you talking about? And I'm like, well, I'm a little worried about the risk of it. And he goes, what are you talking about? And I was like, what do you mean? He goes, Bridger, do you have one parent or two parents that if you failed, let's say your business sucked and it went to crap, would your parents let you move back home with them and you'd have a bed to sleep in or a couch to sleep on and some food in the fridge to eat. And yeah, it'd be embarrassing. It'd be whatever, but like legit, like, would you have a place to go? And I was like, well, yeah, I mean, yeah, obviously it'd be a little embarrassing, but yeah, my parents, you know, I could definitely move back in with them for a little bit, probably not 10 years, but you know, a couple months, I'm sure that would happen. And he goes, then what are you talking about? And he goes, if that's your worst case scenario is that you fail and you have to move in with your parents with a warm bed and food in the fridge. He goes, that's better than 90% of the planet. Your worst case scenario is better than 90% of the planet. What excuse do you have to not go and be successful? And I was like, shoot. I was like, that's so true. And I said another statistic. I can't remember if it was 80 or 90%, but if you live on government assistance in the United States, government assistance, you make more money than it was either 80 or 90% of the rest of the world every day on government assisted living, which is like the bottom, the lowest, whatever crap that people are like, that's my failure point. You're still living better than 80 or 90. I can't remember the exact statistic, 80 or 90% of the entire world. You have no excuse not to take a chance, not to go after it, not to, you know, try something. So anyways, that totally changed my life.
Pretty recently, you have been a pretty big advocate of politics and insider trading. In your opinion, what is really going on and how do the two align?
I mean, yeah, it's something I post about a lot because I think it's just funny. I think it's just, I personally do think it is wrong though. Congress passed up, this is in the United States, passed a bill. This is like 10 years ago that they would self-regulate themselves on what they could and could not trade. And they just had, and it's just funny. It's like they passed a law for themselves to give them anyways, chances. Nancy Pelosi is going to be probably the best hedge fund manager of 2021 and 2022. If you guys don't know, Nancy Pelosi is the Speaker of the House. She joined Congress. I think her net worth was like $1 or $2 million when she joined. Her current net worth is, I think, $121 million. In Congress. And in Congress, you only make 200 grand a year salary. She is notorious for trading. And there's actually accounts and people that copy her trades and make a killing. And there's full accounts and bots that literally just, because she has to within 30 days register her trades and publicly notify the public. So I, you know, it's kind of this joke that Nancy Pelosi does all these things. So a great example is last year, Nancy Pelosi just loaded up on Tesla. And then all of a sudden, a week later, Congress announced that they're going to move all government vehicles to electric cars. And Tesla was their favorite one by, I think, 2025 or 2030, something like that. And then earlier this year, she put a, you know, $5 million stake in Microsoft. And Microsoft got a government contract from the military like 3 weeks later to get these all their goggles, these new goggles they're going to make for the military, and their stock soars, right? She did the same thing with Amazon. Amazon got a new approval from a plant 3 weeks later. Same thing with Nvidia. So finally, this fall, I was like, screw it, I'm going to copy her. She made a big bet on Nvidia. It was like an $8 million bet on Nvidia. I said, I'll buy some. I put some money into Nvidia just to see. And lo and behold, Nvidia was up 60% in a month. This is in this fall, like 3 months ago. And all of a sudden, magically, Nvidia got a government contract. And so it's just blatant. It's just like, come on. Like, are you serious? Like, there is so much conflict of interest there. And so anyways, I think it's ridiculous. The other thing is federal judges. I saw a thing today, actually this morning. There was one federal judge. These are judges that are making decisions on Facebook, Google, all these, you know, big things that are happening in the United States. Judges make decisions on these things. And they are trading the stocks. They know, they're the judge. There was one judge had 130 conflicts of interest on between all the, you know, all of his things that he had come across his desk and all the trades he had made. 130 conflicts of interest. I mean, it is just total blatant. It's just obvious. Bad. Like, this is just bad. That's just bad management. for a, you know, you want people to be impartial. You want them to not have an equity stake in the company that they're deciding the fate of. So anyways, I can go on and on, but it's just, it's almost hilarious what's going on. I personally, I can't change the government, you know, for as one person, I can talk about it online, but I also, I just copy the trades now. I literally, anytime Nancy Pelosi does a trade, I copy it. I put 5, 10, 20 grand, whatever it is, into that trade just to see what'll happen. And man, she is right. It feels like 10 out of 10 times on every trade that she posts. So something to notice.
Do you feel like at some point the regulators, I mean, they are the regulators at the end of the day, right?
That's the problem. Crack down They're not going to crack down on themselves. Why would you crack down on yourself? And that's, you know, it's starting. In the United States, you have the three branches of government. The judicial branch should crack down and say, because they have checks and balances, all three. It really comes down to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court should step in and say, guys, this is an unconstitutional right that you're possessing as Congress members. And that's what should happen. Will it happen? I just think all of them are making too much money doing it. I just don't think it'll happen.
So, Richard, do you think then something is similar is going on potentially with, you know, NFTs or the blockchain or gaming, you know, space, especially this new metaverse?
So yeah, with, you know, I think with money laundering, you know, NFT space is blown up. I mean, I'll two sides of this. There are NFTs that have true value, 100%. And people are going to get mad at me. Oh, Bridger, NFTs are the future. I get it. Like, and I was on a call with one of the co-founders of Decentraland. This is a couple weeks ago. And he mentioned they're selling NFTs in a new thing. And you can own, like, let's say it's this fire sword. That's like, you know, there's only 100 fire swords ever made in this game. You can own the fire sword and then lend it out to people and they pay you, you know, you get a 48 hour rental period and you make money on it, which is kind of cool. You know, like that's awesome. Right. There's definitely useful NFTs. I'm talking about like JPEGs that are like not worth anything. You know what I mean? Like these pictures of dumb, like rocks and just other crap that are selling for millions of dollars. Personally, I put a post out, but I think it's a lot of it's money laundering or tax evasion. There's a huge, you know, art play in tax evasion. Additionally, you can, you know, you put an NFT out. I think it's an inflated market as well. So you launch an NFT project, you and your buddies go buy these NFTs for hundreds of thousands of dollars, setting a market, and then you sell them to yourselves or to you and your buddy trade them and you sell them to each other. So you bought it for $100,000. You sell it to your buddy for $1,000. So you took a $99,000 loss on that NFT. And same with your buddy, your other buddy, he bought one for 100 grand, sold to you for $1,000. You both get $99,000 in losses, but yet you still own an NFT that previously sold for $100,000, right? And so you can, that's a huge tax write-off. And then I just think it's an inflate, like super inflate. I saw some metrics as well. It was like, 90% of NFT trades happen between 10% of users. And a lot of them were, you know, these types of transactions. So I think the current NFT marketplace is pretty fraudulent. I think there's a lot of fraud in there, or just money laundering or tax, you know, stuff like that. But that's kind of what I see currently going on in the NFT space. Now, before I get crucified on here, yes, I do believe in other types of NFTs that'll have tons of value in the metaverse. But like, come on, like a picture of, you know, a rock or something dumb. Like, no, like I don't believe in that as worth $200,000. I think it's for tax purposes or other reasons.
And to wrap up a call with the last couple of questions for the day, based off your experiences you've had so far, what have been some interesting personalities within the investment funds world that, if it weren't for that particularly, that if it weren't for that particular access into this world, that you feel like you would have never had access to?
It's interesting to start learn, like, and I've had access through my dad or other mentors to, you know, ultra high finance, and it's crazy to see what big players are doing, and the billions and even trillions of dollars that are flying over your head that you have no clue what's going on. And it's been interesting for me to look at like the actual bag holders and owners of a lot of these companies or equities or stocks or bonds and who some of the big players. One example is BlackRock. BlackRock is relatively unknown by a lot of people. BlackRock like rules the planet. Like BlackRock is Fed backed $1 trillion asset. I think it's $5 trillion asset manager. They control pretty much the world economy, if you could say that in a light way. Vanguard is another one that no one really talks about. And they have huge, their fingers are spread through every market in the world. I mean, all equities, real estate, venture. I mean, and they have a lot of say in what happens. And so it's been cool to see, you know, types of deals that these big players do that are sometimes private that I get to hear about just because of, you know, nature of relationships. And different things that, you know, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac do for certain players. You have things that just the Fed do to top banks. I mean, it's this world of high finance where it's not like it's almost dollars are their commodity, right? It's not like they're earning, like obviously they're there to earn dollars, make a, you know, create more value, but also like the amount of money that flows between banks and institutions, you know, billions of dollars a day that are lent out. It's just crazy. Anyways, I could go more specifically, but it's a pretty incredible world at the high finance level. And it's really, and there's so much. I just scratched the surface, you know, with my limited experience, but man, it's just cool to see and also scary to see, you know, how much control and just happens at a macro scale.
And for the last and final question, what piece of advice would you give to people out there from the journey you have had so far in life?
Yeah, it's a good question. Number one, it's kind of not probably what you're expecting. I have two things, but number one would be trust in God. I'm a big believer in God, I believe God loves us as his children and is there to help us, whether we love him or not, or care about him or not. I believe in God over all of us. And I take every decision I have to God. I pray about everything, and I'm not perfect by any means. I don't profess to be perfect. I try my best but I believe God loves us and will help us out and will reach out to us. The idea to start Best Fund Secrets totally came from a Heavenly Father. And I was pushed into that business. I really was. I feel like a calling from God to do it. I feel like for a lot of, I pray about every business decision I make. I pray about family and life and friends and all that kind of stuff. So I would say just one thing to leave. I know it's not popular to say nowadays, but I think believing in God and trying to reach out and connect with God. And I can go deeper about, you know, my personal beliefs, but it just in general, just, I think it's hard to deny that there's not something bigger than us. And whether you call it the universe or whatever you want to call it, I believe in it. It's our Father, and we're truly his children. And anyways, that's the first thing I would leave is, you know, consult God, keep him on your, you know, use him as a resource on what you're doing. Number two, I would leave you with is, we live in this just crazy world. By crazy, I mean a good crazy. We live in this time, this period of time that we've never experienced in the history of the world, where we are converging technologies are all hitting right now. The world is flat with the internet. We have 2 billion people now coming online with high-speed internet. We have the, you know, a blockchain of AI, you have flying cars coming. You got everything coming right now. And money is moving at a faster rate right now than ever before. You got to recognize the times and seasons you're in. That was one of the reasons I dropped out of college was because I recognized I am in a very profitable season right now. We are harvesting. And yes, the music might run out soon and I'm prepping for that, whatever. But while the iron's hot, you got to strike. And when capital is ready to go and people right now, it is this huge, the world that we're going through, the largest human migration in the history of the world right now. People are moving from urban areas to suburbs. And secondly, money is moving pockets faster than it ever has before. Guess what? School and college is always there for you. A W-2 salary job is always there for you. Always. If you were in college during 1997, you heard about this internet thing And 1998, and, oh man, maybe I'll do it one day. 1999, then year 2000, you graduate. Yeah, we graduate. I got a job, and all of a sudden, dot-com bubble hits. Oh man, we're out of work. I can't find a job, blah, blah, blah. Same thing. I hear this from people that graduated in like 07, 08. Oh man, I graduated the worst time. And I go, no, you didn't. Why did you go to college during 2004, 2005, 2006, and 2007? Those were some of the highest earning years for people in their lifetimes. And you decided to not care about the times and seasons. And you just sat in college all day. And so anyways, I think you got to recognize the time and the season you're in right now is an incredible opportunity to make generational wealth. And yes, do we go through market swings? 100%. Well, things change 100%. You got to recognize the times and seasons you're in right now. It has never been easier to get funding for a business, never easier to find partners, never easy to learn, never easy to find. Anyways, it's never been easier. And back to what I said before, what do you got to lose? Worst case scenario, you live on somebody's couch for 3 months. Whoop-de-doo. Who cares? That's your worst case scenario. That's not that bad. That's pretty good, actually. Who are you not to go try something? So anyways, that's what I'll leave you with. Trust in God, follow him, and recognize the times and season you're in. So there you go.
And Bridger, for people who are interested in potentially reaching out to you or catching a cup of coffee with you, what would be the best point of contact?
Yeah, so Instagram, Bridger_Pennington is great. YouTube, Bridger Pennington. We put out a lot of videos on funds there. If you guys want, I have a free course on funds. So we put out a whole free course, how to start investment funds, what they are, the whole nine yards. If you go to investmentfundsecrets.com/free gift. So investmentfundsecrets.com/free gift. That will give you a full free, it's like 30 plus videos, downloadable documents, the whole nine yards. So investmentfundseekers.com/free gift.
And for listeners out there, that will be attached in the podcast notes. Bridger, it was a pleasure having you on Geeks of the Valley. And thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you, man. It's been fun to be on. Thank you.